Belle Page is going to introduce me to a novel, not a modern novel. It's quite an old one. It goes back to the middle of the 19th century by Anthony Trollope, and it's the first in a series, and this one's called The Warden.
Well, we read a mixture in our book circle of new and older ones, but it turned out that none of us had ever read any Anthony Trollope. So we decided to start with The Warden and found it well written, characters beautifully drawn, humour. His style of writing is not perhaps what you would be used to, but look for the humour and the asides in it. And it really is very interesting. Basically, the main person in the story is an old vicar who has been given the job of warden over some almshouses in Barchester Cathedral, which some people take to be Winchester Cathedral and some people take to be Salisbury Cathedral.
Mr. Harding is a small man, now verging on 60 years, but bearing few of the signs of age. His hair is rather grizzled than grey. His eye is very mild but clear and bright, though the double glasses which are held swinging from his hand, unless when fixed upon his nose, show that time has told upon his sight. His hands are delicately white, and both hands and feet are small. He always wears a black frock coat, black knee breeches, and black gaiters, and somewhat scandalizes some of his more hyper-clerical brethren by a black neck handkerchief.
The origin of these almshouses came from an old wool merchant back in 1434, whose name was John Hiram, a wool stapler, they called him. And in his will, he built almshouses for 12 old wood carders and enough money to build a fitting residence for a warden to look after them. He'd got a lot of land, and in his will he said a certain sum from the land should be given to the warden who would be looking after these almshouses, and that the old people in the almshouses should have sixpence a day, plus breakfast, plus dinner. The church had raised it to 1 shilling and 4 pence a day for each old person, but the main character in this story, the Reverend Harding, he raised it out of his own money, an extra 2p a day, which doesn't sound very much these days, but it was quite a lot then, and it was out of his own pocket. Over the years, the amount that the warden received had increased out of proportion to the small increase of fourpence for the old people in the almshouses, and the job went with an extra £800 a year. He was also the precentor at the cathedral.
Precentor is just one of a group of clergy. I think he's responsible for the services of worship or something like that.
Now, this old gentleman was he's probably middle-aged. He is a very nice old man. It had never occurred to him, as it hadn't occurred to the people that had held the post before, that perhaps £800 a year is a lot of difference from 1 shilling and 4 pence a day, which he'd put up tuppence out of his own money. But it hadn't really occurred to him. This is something that had gone on for years, and he accepted it. He was a very good warden. He took great care of his old men. He looked after them. They came to him if they'd got troubles. He made sure the food was good that they had, and they lived a very happy life.
And there were just 12 of them, I think. That was
yes.
Right. They were comfortable. They had reached old age. They'd worked hard, and they were physically often a bit limited.
One couldn't even get up and had lost his eye. They had a better life than when they were actually working, when perhaps they didn't have such good lodgings and they didn't have 2 square meals a day. Also, the Reverend Harding was a musical man, and he had written a book of sacred music. He felt a little bit guilty about that because he had paid for it to be published, and he thought perhaps that was a bit unnecessary. He had 2 daughters. Now, one was married to the son of the bishop, and he was an archdeacon. His character was so different from the Reverend Harding's.
In the Diocese of Barchester, the Archdeacon of Barchester did the work. In that capacity, he was diligent, authoritative, and, as his friends particularly boasted, judicious. His great fault was an overbearing assurance of the virtues and claims of his order, and his great foible an equally strong confidence in the dignity of his own manner and the eloquence of his own words.
He was a very good organiser. He liked everybody to behave themselves, and he liked to organise everybody and make sure that they all did as they were told. His name was Dr. Grantley. He considered himself entitled to give counsel to every other being whom he met, And of course, that included his father-in-law and his wife and to the bishop, his own father.
Who was also quite a gentle soul.
Now, the bishop was very friendly with Mr. Harding and often had him for a meal. And they would have a very good meal with wine. And Mr. Harding would go back to his house where he lived with his remaining daughter and not feel at all guilty because he knew that his old men that he looked after, he took a pride in it. And he actually loved his old men, particularly one called Bunce, who seemed to organise all the others, so much so that Mr. Harding called him his deputy, and he was very proud of being called that.
And of course, into this very comfortable world in which everything trundles along quite happily, those who have the position of power as well as money either don't think about anything much, they don't think there's anything wrong with it, this is the way it's always been, but we're in the middle of the 19th century and change is afoot.
Yes.
And into this happy environment comes a reformer, a zealous reformer, by the name of John Bold.
Yes.
Now, of course, names throughout this are interesting because you've got Septimus Harding is our main character, the elderly warden of this house. And then you've got Archdeacon Grantly. I can't quite work out what that means, but there were some other names we'll come to later, I expect. But John Bold comes in determined that things should change. This is not right.
Yes. One man held this post of warden, which he looked on as a sinecure. He said no duties with it. And he got 800 a year. And these old men were getting 1 shilling and fourpence a day. He was full of zealous enthusiasm for reforming the whole business. Unfortunately, he was nearly engaged to Harding's other daughter, who is a sweet young thing. She loves her father very much. She also loves John Bold. But when he starts stirring up the trouble and beginning to say that this is wrong, that something is wrong in the church, and that there's corruption in high places, and a lot of people in the church are taking money for themselves to lead a good life to the detriment of the very poor people who can't cope. And of course, at that time, when this story was written, there was such a case going on.
Yes, I think it was that was actually in Winchester, that particular situation. Mm. That was one that was going through the courts. And therefore, the situation that you have described for the warden and the old men that he looked after, of course, once they began to think, hang on, this isn't quite right, majority of them got a bit stirred, saying, well, I want my rights as well. And poor old Septimus Harding began to worry himself because he thought, well, I hadn't really thought about this very much. Mm.
Could it be possible that John Bold was right, and that the Reverend Warden of the hospital had been for the last 10 years and more the unjust recipient of an income legally and equitably belonging to others? What if it should be proved before the light of day that he, whose life had been so happy, so quiet, so respected, had absorbed £8,000, to which he had no title, and which he could never repay? I do not say that he feared that such was really the case, but the first shade of doubt now fell across his mind. And from this evening, for many a long, long day, our good, kind, loving warden was neither happy nor at ease.
And his instinct was to say, well, you're right, it isn't the way it should be. His son-in-law, Archdeacon Grantly, had other thoughts, because to give way would be to put the church at risk, to expose the power structure, if you like.
And he said that his father-in-law had to stand firm and not give way.
And I think the bishop, probably like all good bishops, prevaricated. He was on both sides.
Oh, yes.
He wandered from one side to the other. I'm not sure quite.
Yeah, I think really the bishop was a little bit weak and he was frightened of his
son
who was pushing him into keeping the status quo and not knocking down the whole building. The book has been described as a drama of conscience that puts individual integrity against worldly ambition. Now, individual integrity, that is Reverend Harding. But the ambition, that's John Bold and Archdeacon Grantly. But John Bold really is a young man. He's full of enthusiasm. And Bold is the name for him. He sort of jumps into things without realising the consequences. He's in love with Harding's lovely daughter. I don't think he even stops to think what this is going to do to her father. This is saying that her father is not a good man, that he's taking money that doesn't belong to him.
Bold is idealistic, isn't he? Grantly, the archdeacon, is the protect the system as it is, it should go on because it's too dangerous. If you rock the boat, the boat tips over.
Yes.
And you got that sort of conflict, which was very much what was going on in the world out there. You had the power structure versus the revolutionaries, the reformists that were coming up. I mean, probably one of the reasons why we don't read so many Trollope is that we read more Dickens. I mean, Dickens was a reformer. And it is said that one of the characters in here is actually Dickens in disguise.
Well, that was a book written by Mr. Popular Sentiment, in which he is thinly disguised this situation that there's the old men living in poverty and while the rich vicar has all the money, which isn't really the case at all, because the old men are having a better life than they've ever had. But once they involve the press, the famous Jupiter make a series of articles showing Reverend Harding as a rich, thoughtless person who is holding a job for which he doesn't have to do anything and living at the expense of these poor old men. Nothing is further from the truth.
But of course, Bold, the reformer, is unaware of how easy it is to be manipulated by the media.
By the media.
How contemporary
Absolutely,
are we?
Absolutely, yes.
He comes up with a proposal for change. The guy who runs the editor of the paper says, here's a nice story I can develop. And he really turns it way beyond what Bold would like.
There's a bit that I thought I'd like to put in about the power of the press. I won't say the name of the paper, but it did remind me of one of the daily papers.
Were it not well for us in our ignorance that we confided all things to the Jupiter? Would it not be wise in us to abandon useless talking, idle thinking, and profitless labour? Away with majorities in the House of Commons, with verdicts from judicial bench given after much delay, with doubtful laws and the fallible attempts of humanity. Does not the Jupiter, coming forth daily with 80,000 impressions full of unerring decision on every mortal subject, set all matters sufficiently at rest? Is not Tom Towers here, able to guide us and willing?
Is that so different from some of the newspapers that we have today?
Well, that's the irony, because when we started off, I said, this is really quite an old... We're going back to something that's got a sort of style that we don't really think we're not accustomed to. We're much more used to the modern novels of various periods in the last 50 years, which are completely different from style. Mm-hmm. And here is something which is very straightforward and very authoritative. And in fact, all he's done is develop characters that we can transpose into contemporary situation, including between those who want to protect society as it is and those who want to reform it, want to change it, that reform sometimes leads to things beyond where you want to go, and somebody else takes advantage of this. In this case, the media come in and they started. It's very contemporary in an ironic way.
It is. The final blow for poor old Harding is when the journalist came with a petition for all his old men to sign, and he told them that if they won, they'd get an extra £100 a year, and that not only would they get it, they were entitled to it. And Bunce, the sensible one, he tried to dissuade them all from signing. Most of them couldn't sign anyway. They had to put a cross, and somebody said who'd signed it. About half of them didn't want to sign it because they knew they were comfortable and well off, but they were more or less dragooned into it by the hotheads who wanted £100 a year. And they thought, £100 a year, what would we do with that? What would they do with it? They've got a good home, they've got good food, they've got a life which is better than they've had before. But in the end, reluctantly, everyone makes their mark. Harding had always looked on them as his friends. In fact, it said in one place he loved them, and he did. You love the people you care for, don't you? And he did care for them. If they weren't well, he got help for them. He made sure that they were well-dressed and well-fed. He played his violoncello to them, and they all would come round and listen to him playing like a group of friends. And then Bunce would stay afterwards and have a glass of wine with him. And that was great. But for them to turn on him, I think that finally brought home to him that he was at fault, that he shouldn't be living this good life and having an £800, and he would resign. And he had greatest difficulty in resigning because he knew that his son-in-law, the archdeacon, wouldn't allow him to. And he had to fool him. He had to set off the day before when the archdeacon was doing something else and make his way to London so that he could see the powers that be and put his resignation in.
There's some wonderful names in there as well. We mentioned some of them, but there's also the lawyer, the London barrister, Abraham Haphazard.
The one who wrote the pamphlet on the decay of the world called Dr. Pessimist Anticant. Yes, I like that one. And Mr. Popular Sentiment, that you said you think
there has been a suggestion that it's Charles Dickens in disguise. George Orwell, he thought this was probably the best, the most successful of Trollope's classic series and one of his best works. But he did suggest that although Trollope was a shrewd critic of human nature and of these things that we've pulled out, he wasn't in fact a reformer. He wasn't really keen to push.
I think here and there was gentle sarcasm.
In the world, Dr. Grantly never lays aside that demeanour which so well becomes him. He has all the dignity of an ancient saint with the sleekness of a modern bishop. He is always the same, he is always the archdeacon. Unlike Homer, he never nods. Even with his father-in-law, even with the bishop and dean, he maintains that sonorous tone and lofty deportment which strikes awe into the young hearts of Barchester and absolutely cows the whole parish of Plumstead Episcopi. It is only when he has exchanged that ever-new shovel hat for a tasselled nightcap, and those shining black habiliments for his accustomed robe de nuit, that Dr. Grantly talks and looks and thinks like an ordinary man. Many of us have often thought how severe a trial of faith must this be to the wives of our great church dignitaries.
It's fun, it's humorous, it's fairly light, but it's got a hidden undercurrent to it, which one can explore and one can take away and think. Yes, it is over 150 years old, this book, but it was writing at a time when things were about to change.
Yes.
We get stuck into other periods where things seem to get stopped and then desire for change comes again. So worth learning something. So old Trollope has some things to say
to us. It does, and I enjoyed it, and I shall read some more.
Thanks, Val. Our thanks, as always, to Calibre Audio for providing us with a CD of this title so that we can take extracts from it. The Warden by Anthony Trollope was read by Timothy West. The audio version runs for approximately 6.5 hours. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.